the Psych Podcast, a podcast where we discuss all things intro psych. I am joined by my friend, my colleague, Paul Bloom. Welcome, Paul.
Good to talk to you again, David.
Today we have to have a spotless discussion because it is about the topic of rationality. So if we make any error, the irony will actually bring us down.
Just like when we talk about memory, we always forget our stories. When we talk about language, we're disfluent.
That's right. This is a big question. I mean, I know all of these are big questions, but this is one of the big questions. I mean, this is what distinguishes us from the animals, right? We are rational creatures. We have the ability to use logic, to use reason, induction, deduction, to arrive at truth. And that surely is what separates humankind from the mere beasts of the field.
That's very, very, very lyrical.
Thank you.
Yeah, man is the rational animal. You know, there's a lot of debate about things, but I'm not sure there's anybody I know who disagree with what you said just now, which is we can do logic and higher mathematics and advanced reasoning. We've come up with abstract theories of space and time. We've come up with science far, far beyond what any other creature can do. Here we are talking about the mind, and you know, it's so beyond what anybody else could do. But there is a big debate in our field over whether to think of this rationality as something fundamental to our being, to how we think, versus this sort of really great thing we could sometimes very rarely do. And most of the time we're disasters at it.
Right. That we can learn calculus doesn't mean that we're using those tools even 1% of the time. There's a historical arc to this argument, which is that we were very proud of our rationality and our intelligence as a species. It used to be that we were portrayed as godlike in our ability to reason.
The spirit of the Enlightenment.
But you bring in Darwin saying, well, we're animals. We're just a little bit different than other animals. And someone like Freud who says, yeah, you thought you were guided by reasoning and rationality and all this stuff, but you're really just guided by the dumb, baser instincts. You just don't know it. And you have somebody like Skinner who comes along and says, reason, what are you even talking about? This is all essentially a fancy version of the reflex arc, right? Where we are stimulus, response. And then you get the icing on the cake, social psychology in the last 50 years that says, well, let's catalog all of the ways in which we make very, very dumb errors. Sort of dethroning us as the reasoner supreme.
That's a nice summary. There's a friend of ours who teaches a very popular intro psych course. And as I was preparing to teach mine for the first time, I asked her, you know, is there a big argument she makes? And she said, absolutely. I try to convince the undergraduates they're not as smart as they think they are. I try to convince them that psychology shows that we're full of, she called them mind bugs, where, you know, our mental faculties don't work as well as we think they do. And we really should know this and try to compensate for our terrible weaknesses.
In social psychology, such a central theme.
The motto to social psychologists is the power of the situation. And often that's a rebuke to people who say, well, we reason our way through, we're rational agents, we're moral agents. No, you're just a sucker to the power of the situation. Put you in this situation, you'll behave this way. Put you in another one, you behave that way. There's even some social psychologists who are at heart skeptical about the very idea of even conscious deliberation, that the voice you have in your head, if it exists at all, is epiphenomenal, plays no role. We're just pawns. We're just molecules bouncing around.
Right. And so you have these classic demonstrations where people believe that they're arriving at a decision or a judgment based on deliberation, but you can demonstrate through the experimental method that the experimenter was actually in control of why they made a decision. So for instance, if I show you a particular set of works of art, and I ask you which one you like the best, and you say, well, I've always been a fan of Impressionism. I sort of like this palette of colors, so I like this one the best. And then I, as an experimenter, say, ha-ha, no, it's just because people tend to choose the last of the set, and I can show that on average people choose the last.
Timothy Wilson did a lot of that work, and he wrote a book called Strangers to Ourselves. You know, we think we're in charge, but we're not. We don't actually have any sense of what's going on. So you have all of that. And then you toss in, and this is what how my chapter on the topic is framed. You toss in what I think just about everybody agrees is one of the great success stories of psychology, which is the collaboration between Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Tversky passed away so many years ago, but Kahneman's still alive and doing wonderful, interesting work. And he won the Nobel Prize for his work. And the work seemed to catalog human irrationality. It created the field of behavioral economics, driving us away from the economist's image of a rational individual, rational agent, and really persuaded many psychologists that irrationality is the rule when it comes to our mental life.
The stroke of genius in Kahneman Tversky's work was not just to demonstrate or to claim that we're irrational or stupid, but to show that we were stupid in very systematic ways, that there were some errors that we were prone to making that led to bad decisions, bad judgments all the time. And it's because we use a particular set of rules of thumb, or heuristics, as they refer to them. And these heuristics would systematically lead us astray.
I'm starting to live in terror of someone who's going to listen to us and then have to leave and break loose of the podcast right now and think, wow, humans are irrational. Those guys got it down. So I just want to kind of plant a flag on the idea that this entire skeptical view is deeply overstated. And I think you and I may disagree on the margins, but I think we both agree that there's a fundamental rationality that humans possess.
Absolutely. The first paper that you and I worked on together was a defense of rationality in the moral domain, which we'll get to here. But in many ways, that paper, I think, represents something that I still believe, I think you still believe, which is that all of this research certainly shows something. But it doesn't show nearly as strongly as people think it does that we're just dumb.
And I'll make a simple, you know, just make the simple point, which is we're going to discuss some of these examples of biases people possess. And they're very real. But at the same time, the fact that we're discussing them and understanding that they're biases, and the fact that people are going to listen to us and say, wow, oh yeah, we do this, but that's a mistake, tells us two things about the mind. One is that we have these biases, but the second thing is we're smart enough to recognize them as biases.
You make, as many people have made, a comparison between visual illusions and these kinds of heuristics or biases. You could argue that taking the evidence that we use a particular set of heuristics to arrive at judgments and that these heuristics can often lead us astray, to take that as evidence of irrationality would be akin to arguing that because visual illusions are strong and easy to demonstrate in the lab, that we're walking around just tripping over ourselves and falling off cliffs. And we don't do that. The very reason that we are efficient at navigating our physical environment is that we have very effective rules that convert the incoming information for us so that we don't have to explicitly calculate how far away an object is. And so you might say that that's true of cognitive illusions as well, that, well, these heuristics are interesting, but only in as much as in the lab you can show that they lead judgment astray. All that means is that in the real world, they don't lead us astray most of the time.
Yeah. And I think somebody arguing with us, so I think the analogy is a good one. I think just as visual illusions are the product of an incredibly sophisticated machine for analyzing the environment that under weird conditions gives rise to error, cognitive illusions are precisely the same way. We are terrific reasoners in the real world. And sometimes, inevitably, we get it wrong and we call these illusions, and psychologists figure out clever ways we get it wrong. But one disanalogy, and I'm sensitive to this, is some of these cognitive illusions really matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably in real world, visual illusions never matter. You know, maybe for some weird cases with you know, pilots or some special cases, some illusions matter. For the most part, you could never learn about them in your life and be fine. But the cognitive illusions, I think because the cognitive illusions arise because of the world we live in. I think this is in some sense a case of a mismatch, that our reasoning mechanisms evolved for a much simpler world with fewer people, no technology, simple interactions. And now in our modern world, we these things can make a difference. Let's just get concrete. So one of them, the easiest one to think about is I think the availability bias. And so, and this is the idea that that when we have to compute how frequent something is, we often defer to how quickly it comes to mind. So there's like a million examples of this. There's a laboratory example, which is it's a lot easier to come to think about words that begin with a certain letter, the letter B, than words that have a certain letter as their third letter or their fourth letter. So we mistakenly think the first is more frequent even when it isn't. Maybe the part that really matters is you ask people, how likely is it that you'll die in a terrorist attack or a plane crash or get killed by a shark or something versus heart attacks, strokes, car accidents. And people radically overestimate the likelihood of very rare but salient events and terribly underestimate, you know, more mundane events that don't make it on in the newspaper or in the news.
And so here, the salient events that you're referring to, like dying in terrorist attack, are salient because they're vivid and emotional, and we encode them in memory. Hearing about somebody who got eaten by a shark is something you're not likely to forget.
That's right. That's right. And then next year in Cape Cod, you're waiting, and one of that really comes to mind. That's big. That's memorable.
There is some analysis that in the summer that followed the 9/11 attacks, many more people took to their cars for vacation. And so the number of deaths went up because, as it turns out, cars are much more dangerous than air travel.
Yeah. And that's an example of how in our modern world, this makes a difference.
And there are some reasons, you know, driving a car is unlike flying in a plane in many ways. One of the ways is that you have a sort of bias that you have control over your own destiny when you're driving the car.
Not the way I drive.
And nobody has control when you drive. Infrequent events are going to be reported on more as well. Right. Nobody would want to watch the nightly news where it just reported on all the car accidents that occurred in America.
Yeah. Let alone the nightly news that reported on all the crimes that didn't happen. You know.
Right.
You know, this whole street was really safe for the last 6 months, you know. As a result of that, our statistics are skewed. So having an availability bias, it's not stupid. It's actually for a creature who doesn't have access to Excel sheets and, you know, and statistics and summaries of data. That is, most creatures and Homo sapiens for a long, long time. It's not a bad way to go. But in a modern world where there's sort of a news ecology, perfectly reasonable, which is you focus on the extremes, on the terrible, it leads to people with a lot of skewed ideas in the world.
This is something you were sort of alluding to before when you were talking about a disanalogy, but one of the real differences between modern life and life before modern times is simply just the amount of information that we have available to us. So what it means to make a good decision, if that means to take into account relevant information, it is a computationally much more challenging process now than it has ever been.
Yeah. And I think another thing is that people, I think, at sort of a gut level know about these biases, and then they use them against other people to try to manufacture certain views. And we don't tend to have visual illusions. Maybe there's some sort of complicated con games that involve visual illusions, but it's hard to think of many.
You're going to mock me again for my references about Wile E. Coyote uses visual illusions all the time.
Yes, I've worn shirts with stripes to make me look taller. To fool those suckers out there. But, you know, you can imagine some kind of really ugly cases where people who want to frighten you about some group tell you these lurid stories about crimes the group commits, knowing that people are going to hear this and say, wow, we really are in danger. And the more lurid the stories, the more scary it is. As a more benign example, there's a second heuristic, which is we call the framing effect, which is how something is framed, the very same fact will influence people's determination of it.
You say it well here. It's better to describe something as 95% effective than as failing 5% of the time. By getting people to focus on that large number that is the success rate, you get them to ignore the 5% that is the failure.
Right. And we're good at naturally framing. That's what advertisers do. And I think you're nicely capturing the visual illusion style quality of all of this, which is I understand that terrorist attacks and plane crashes and violent crime are relatively rare. But like a visual illusion, it's hard not to see it that way, to feel it in your gut. I understand that how something is framed doesn't make a difference. But still, when you see these things, you respond to them.
It's an intuitive pull. And that intuitive system, the system that is responsible for taking all this information, using these shortcuts, these heuristics to guiding our decisions and spitting out an answer, is fast, it feels right, and it requires little deliberation. Right? People often refer to this, following Kahneman, as system one.
So Kahneman took a distinction, and he fully acknowledged this, that's been around for a very long time, at least since Plato, between a sort of emotive appetite part of the mind that makes quick decisions, that goes with the gut, that system one, he called it, and then a more reflective, deliberative part of mind, which is system two. And he actually has a lovely book summarized a lot of his research, which called Thinking Fast and Slow, where system one is fast, system two is slow. And there's some debate within psychology as to whether these two systems, whether this should be sort of a manner of talking, like, you know, we could split up what people do into two ways, or whether there really are two neurologically, cognitively distinct systems in the head. I'm kind of agnostic. So there's some smart psychologists who say there's just one system. It's more or less in the sort of how it's used or how it's deployed and so on. And the arguments here bring us really into the weeds.
I'm of the opinion that it is a handy way of talking. And all it means really is that sometimes you can make an effort to deliberate and think hard about something. And sometimes you're sort of on autopilot. A lot of the errors that you see us make can be corrected when you get people to think more deliberately about what decisions they're making. So sometimes people don't fall prey to framing effects. Sometimes they don't fall prey to availability.
Yeah, I like that. I think it's such an important fact, which we often forget, that we could reflect upon these mistakes. We could laugh at them. We could be embarrassed about them. And when we make an effort, when the stakes are high, we can do a lot better. Now, one thing that complicates things, which is gets into your turf as somebody who's primarily a social psychologist, is that sometimes these biases are not sort of cold, effective computational biases, but they serve a sort of social role. So there's what's called the my side bias. It goes under different names. Motivated reasoning is another way of looking at things, which basically is a bias to see the world in some way that is to your benefit.
Now, you would think that there would be such a premium on capturing reality as it is, that we would be creatures that strive for accuracy all the time. But as you make the point in your book, the goal of the organism isn't necessarily to be accurate.
Yeah, we're social creatures. Often we want to persuade other people. Often we want to persuade ourselves we're doing the right thing. We want to defend our groups. We want to defend ourselves. You know, I'm a big fan of rationality, but sometimes you want to take a broad view of rationality and realize that for a rational, self-interested being, or interest in those we love or those we care about, often the answer you want isn't necessarily the sort of objectively right answer.
Let's take something that's in my life, the World Cup, the soccer football tournament. It involves me to the point where I am not eating right. I'm not sleeping right. Now, this isn't rational by any stretch of the imagination, but if you were to ask me, would you prefer to be perfectly rational and not care about the World Cup, I would say no. There's something deeply meaningful to me about being part of a group that brings me joy.
Yeah, you're better off in so many ways thinking as you do rather than be kind of a rational, you know, person. Rational in the sense of you want to get things right. Now, if you started putting money down, then things get a little bit different. And then you have different values competing with one another.
A friend of mine once wrote an op-ed where he took this rational framework. He said, suppose that you are a sports fan and you really love a team, the Yankees, say. You will be very happy if they win and you will be sad if they lose. Now, why not, he argued, bet against your team, hedging your bet, so that if you lose, you might take a hedonic hit because your team lost, the team you identify with lost, but your bank account will get a boost. And so he outlined this, what he believed was a reasonable strategy. And I thought to myself, this is a guy who's not fun at parties.
Is he an economist?
No, he's in the field of judgment decision making.
Ah, there we go. Yeah. Yeah. I remember telling my younger son, who's very sharp, he was an adorable little kid. And he did something very, very nice. And I said, oh, you're like the best kid in the world. And he looked up at me and said, you're just saying that because you're my father. You know, it's a totally different kid to say that. You're just biased. And I said, I'm not biased. You really are the best kid in the world. He said, well, of course you believe that. He's a very, very cynical little kid.
This episode of the Psych Podcast is once again brought to you by GiveWell.org. We're proud to continue working with GiveWell because we fundamentally believe in the work that they're doing. GiveWell is an organization that is simply trying to maximize the impact of charitable donations. Because when you give to charity, it's hard to know how much impact your donation will actually have. Where do you get the information to know exactly where your dollars are going? It's difficult, if not impossible, to answer that question for most charities. GiveWell dedicates themselves to doing research to answer just this question. GiveWell spends over 40,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funding to a few of the highest impact, evidence-backed opportunities they've found. Over 100,000 donors have already used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. And the evidence suggests that these donations will save over 150,000 lives, as well as improve the lives of millions more. Importantly, GiveWell makes all of this research available for free on their website because they want as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about their charitable donations. So they publish it on their website, they give recommendations for free, you don't even have to sign up, and when they allocate your tax-deductible donation to charities or funds that you choose, they won't take a cut. So, if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $500 before the end of the year or as long as matching funds last. In order to do that, all you have to do to claim your match is go to givewell.org and pick podcast and enter psych at checkout. Once again, that's givewell.org, pick podcast and enter psych at checkout.
There's these great laboratory demonstrations. My favorite, this is from Julia Galef. I'm a huge fan of her. And she wrote this book called The Scout Mindset. And she distinguishes this from the soldier mindset, which is what we're talking about. A soldier mindset roots for their team, thinks their friends are the best in the world, thinks their favorite politicians could do no wrong, and treats reasoning as if they're sort of a soldier trying to advance and take an enemy position. The scout mindset, it keeps an open mind. And she argues we should be more scouts than soldiers, but she has these lovely studies on our soldier mentality. My favorite one is this. It's a study which asks people two different questions. So one question, and they're the same question. One question is, if you get sued and win the case, should the person who sued you pay your legal costs? And almost everybody says yes. Then you ask people this. If you sue somebody and you lose the case, should you pay that person's legal costs? And most people say no. And it's the same question. But you're not.
And I read that and I still agreed.
Yeah, that's right. You agree with both of them. I think thinking about the social utility of reasoning allows you to both retain the idea that we're fundamentally rational creatures, we're really good at it, but also allow for cases where we deviate from objective reality. I think one way to think of it, what is rationality? Well, rationality is often reasoning in the right way to succeed at a goal. If your goal is to get things dead on right, that's one thing. If your goal is to be popular, that might push you in a different way.
So you're saying be Machiavellian. Even if it requires you to abuse the principles of reason and logic in order to gain friends. That's a kind of rationality, I hear you saying.
So I am torn on this. You're making fun of me, and because it's deservedly so. It seems very cynical. It seems cynical to say the smart thing to do is to believe what the people around you do, because otherwise people won't like you. But, you know, if my sons believed that dinosaurs lived with cavemen, I'd be mortified. And I don't care whether everyone else around them believed them. You don't want to believe stupid things.
I feel the pull of those two fundamental drives. To go back to sports, if you see an interview of the, say, the star of a basketball team right before a game, whose team has no chance of winning,
yeah,
and you ask the guy, what do you think about your odds today? If they said, well, I looked over the numbers and it's not looking good, Fred, you would think, this is a terrible teammate.
Yeah.
They may be right, but we don't like people who are rational in that sense when we want them to be loyal. And maybe it's, maybe we're playing a game. Maybe we all know he's lying. Maybe he believes it. But it's not at all obvious that the ideal way to be is to be 100% rational 100% of the time.
That's right. There are cases where believing something which is mistaken can actually be beneficial. It's one of the, so you know, a sort of textbook example is over-exaggerating certain dangers could lead you to be wary. And this wariness could be an inconvenience, but in the end, it could you know, save you if the dangers are sort of dangerous enough. So, you know, is having sort of a phobia of snakes and taking them too seriously in certain environments could be pretty smart, as opposed to somebody gets the odds really right. But there's also a social thing. So apparently the odds, suppose the odds of getting of a marriage ending in divorce is about 50%. Well, if you ask people just as they get married, how likely are you to get divorced? They will typically say, I'm 0%. I'm not going to get divorced. Maybe, 1%. These crazy things happen. But they're very unlikely to answer you with 50%. Suppose they did answer you with 50%. You may think, that's a pretty cold-eyed, rational approach to this relationship you're entering into. Maybe the positive illusion that your marriage isn't going to end helps keep your marriage together.
This view of positive illusions being beneficial is championed by the social psychologist Shelley Taylor, who I think made a powerful argument that this is the case in many domains. Believing when you're sick that you're going to get better apparently is better than believing that you're not going to get better.
Yeah. One of the sort of, if we're clinical psychology, there is a lot of debate over what makes a therapist or a therapy better than another one. And there's, to a surprising extent, apparently, it doesn't matter. As long as you have a halfway decent therapist and they don't do anything too awful with you, it's sort of called the dodo bird effect, after a line in Alice in Wonderland where the dodo bird says everyone wins prizes. And one argument here is that all therapies contain kind of the same thing. And one of these things is the relationship, somebody caring for you. But another one is what you're talking about, which is hope. And thinking that, hey, this might work. I have somebody who cares for me, someone who kind of knows stuff, and they're going to work on my very serious problems with me. Maybe I'll get better. I think is a real ingredient for getting better.
All obviously within reason, so to speak.
Yeah, within reason.
But this is what makes a discussion about rationality so challenging, because it isn't as if there are formal logical rules that can lead to the right answer. And if you violate those, they'll lead to the wrong answer. You really need to place a value on what kind of error you're willing to make and what will happen when you make that sort of an error. An example that I love to use is from the movie Dumb and Dumber, when Jim Carrey's character, who's very dumb, is in love with a woman, but it's clearly unrequited love and he's just not getting the hint. And so he takes a moment and asks her in all seriousness, what are the chances that you will ever get together with me? And she says, 1 in 1,000,000. And we see him look for a moment as if his heart's about to break. And then his concerned face turns into a smile and he says, so you're saying there's a chance?
Yes.
And that's a case where hope will lead you astray. That math just doesn't work out. Which leads to this, I think something I love to talk about, which is motivated reasoning, confirmation bias. I like it because it is a way in which you can demonstrate that two sincere people can arrive at very different conclusions just based on how they went into it, what they want to believe, what their preferences and beliefs already are. And so confirmation bias is essentially ignoring information that goes against your belief and paying attention to information that is consistent with your belief. And we do this all the time. As a scientist, I see a study that is consistent with some of the work that I've done. I chalk it up in my "I was right" column. If I see somebody report on something that disagrees with my particular theoretical approach or my work, I kind of ignore it. I mean, I try not to.
You try not to, but even if you picked it up, you'd be much more attuned to the flaws in that paper.
And that's what gets me to this other big point that I wanted to talk to you about. So far, we have a story built by Kahneman, Tversky, the work of social psychologists and behavioral economists, that says system one is this fast, effortless, quick way of making decisions that can often lead us astray, toss into that list of heuristics, this confirmation bias, that of attending to information that's consistent with your view. But system two is the cure. You just need to realize that sometimes you should work hard and put in that effort to deliberate, and then you can make these biases go away. And in fact, a lot of the messaging around this is to de-bias, just think a bit harder.
Yeah.
But there is this wrinkle, which is that, just as you were saying a minute ago, when we are presented with information that goes against what we already believe, we do think hard about it. The problem is that there is an asymmetry in when we think hard and when we think quickly. And so the psychologist Pete Ditto has done, I think, my favorite set of studies demonstrating this. He basically gave broad undergraduates into the lab and said, "Hey, I have a test. It's a little health test. It'll let you know whether you have this particular kind of disease." I don't know how he got away with it ethically, by the way. But
simpler times.
Simpler times. He said, "This is the test. You dip this piece of paper into your mouth, and then you dip that paper into this solution." And for some of the people, he said, if the solution turns a different color, that means you have the disease. For some of the people, he said, if the solution stays the same, if it stays clear, then you have the disease. And so some people believe that it's a good thing for the solution to turn a color. That means they're healthy. Some people think that it's a bad thing. For the people who believed that the liquid not changing color was good, they would dip the paper into their mouth, dip it into the solution, see that it didn't change, smile and put the paper aside and say, "I'm healthy." The people who thought that the liquid had to change in order to be healthy would dip it into their mouth, dip it into the liquid, see that the liquid didn't turn color, dip it into their mouth again,
yeah,
dip it into the liquid, wait. They're going to great effort to prove to themselves that they are healthy. And he said, this is what we do cognitively. When presented with information that goes against what we believe, it's not that we're dumb. We work hard in those cases. We deploy all of those faculties of rationality that you, Paul, were saying we had to begin with. The amazing abilities that we have to think critically, to distinguish truth from falsehood. And so if you and I disagree, say, on climate change, I send you an article that says climate change is a hoax. You tear it to bits with all of the tools you have as a scientist, right? You say, "Well, who did this study? I've never heard of these people. What was the methodology?" I see it's exactly what I believe. I just forward it to you. Now you forward me something that says climate change is a serious problem, a huge threat. You saw it and you just sent it. I see it. And now I deploy all of my rationality and come up with all sorts of reasons why the study is flawed or the paper is flawed. And so two people who both see themselves as thinking very hard when they need to can come to completely different conclusions. And
yeah.
That's distressing and a bit humbling.
It is. And to some extent that says, well, if we're rational, we have these rational capacities and we often deploy them to worthwhile ends, either sort of getting things right or becoming, are helping ourselves socially. But sometimes, you're right, we deploy them in silly ways. We deploy them in self-protective ways that are not good in the long run. A very simple version of Ditto's point is, nobody goes to a doctor, gets told you don't have cancer, and says, I'm getting a second opinion.
That's right.
You don't get a second opinion. You get a second opinion when it's news you don't like. And this issue pervades everything. Think, you know, not many, some people don't look at scientific papers, but everybody talks about politics. And the standard discourse in politics, which is inevitably right, is you point to somebody you hate and say, look at what this person did. That is disqualifying as a leader. It's disgusting and vile. And then someone responds, you know, your person, what if your person did that? My person would never do that. But of course, often your person did do that. And he said, fully understandable. And it's a sort of coalitional thought that makes a lot of discourse impossible.
I know that it's easy to vilify people for doing this. In fact, go on Twitter now and see people accusing each other of hypocrisy, inconsistency all the time. But I think it is important when you put together all of this work showing that sometimes we're lazy and we're sloppy, that we're coalitional, that sometimes we selectively deploy reason, that we have even biases in our memory. What you end up with is really two people who can be sincere. I'm saying all of the discourses includes two sincere people, but two people can disagree and really not see how the other person could ever come to believe what they believe, given how much effort and time they've put into thinking about this. You don't see what you don't do.
That's nice.
You cannot see all of the steps that you didn't take.
And it happens over and over again. We're here again, we see some analogies. So what we're talking now about decision-making and coming in and reasoning, but it's true, as you point out, it's true for memory as well. You know, you and I have this big fight, and I remember it as you were terrible to me. You remember it as I was terrible to you. We're both sincere. We're not lying. We really remember it that way. Even in vision, I guess it's a little bit strained, but in vision, sometimes you have these displays that two people, like half the world sees it as one way, like the famous dress, which half the world saw as one array of colors, the other half different. Again, no one's lying. It's just their systems are coming out with different outputs.
Paul, there is, I think, one domain in which rationality seems to be of vital importance, and it seems to be more and more important lately, and that is the domain of conspiracy theories. And I know you have some thoughts. You talk about them in your chapter at some length.
I do. And, you know, when you write these chapters, you send them out to friends and colleagues for comments. And I have a friend of mine who hated what I said about conspiracy theory, got very angry at me and wrote me a very, very long email and called me on the phone to yell at me. So these are touchy issues. But if you made the claim that people are rational and fundamental, our minds are working well, you have to explain, why do we mess up on these availability bias experiments? And, you know, I argue like that, well, it could be seen as similar to illusions. And often if you change how you ask the questions, people do much better. You have to explain why we're so seemingly so irrational when it comes to morality and politics. And part of just like we're talking about now is we're irrational if our goals are to get things right. But sometimes we have other goals. We have goals of fitting of a crowd and self-protection. I think for politics, it's often much more close to your support of your sports team than it is to sort of an objective scientific project.
Like John Haidt says, it's all Red Sox Yankees.
Yeah. Yeah. And John Haidt said, I think, and you and I actually have disagreed with John in the past, but there's a deep truth to this, to when he says, we like to think of ourselves as judges, you know, with the facts in front of us making a decision, but we're actually more like lawyers trying to defend the case. And I think David Hume, I think I heard you have a discussion about David Hume, and Hume said something quite similar. But then I have to sort of get to, and I get this in the book, with what seems to be the most irrational thing we do, and it's something which people talk about a lot nowadays, and these are conspiracy theories. And conspiracy theories come in all different shapes and sizes, everything from QAnon to, you know, we've been invaded by lizard people who are taking over the world, to Trump colluded with Russia to win election, to George Bush knew about the 9/11 attacks and let them happen. And, you know, it's a very, very long list. And the fact that people believe in these suggests to many people, many, many critics, that we're crazy. We are naturally conspiracy-minded, naturally foolish. So I don't know. I got my take on it. What's your take?
I grew up, as you did, in an era where there wasn't easy access to the world's information. There were barely internet forums where people could talk about this stuff. The information that you did get that was in any way inconsistent with, say, your local community would be sometimes off of cable, but even cable news was, you know, fairly non-conspiratorial. But you always had that one kid who had read that book or had clippings from some magazine that presented a conspiracy theory, and they were kind of kooky, but it was kind of intriguing. I could feel the pull of believing in that stuff. And I remember getting books even in college about, you know, the Illuminati and the Freemasons. And there's something just so interesting about maybe believing that so much of the world around me is controlled by a select few who are making the decisions. And then the internet happens and you get this explosion of accessibility to all of this information. It's not just one kooky kid in your high school. It is thousands and thousands of people, of course, a minute fraction of the world's population, but who are all so convinced about a particular conspiracy theory that it starts sounding plausible. And yeah. So you join that little community and pretty soon you're a flat earther. So descriptively, I think that conspiracy belief in conspiracies is on the rise because all of that information is just available to anybody who wants to see it. I can see young David being intrigued by the conspiracy theory. Maybe I would be a mess right now if I had been raised in this era. Now, I'm very low on belief in conspiracies. It is my bias, perhaps. And I should be a little more lenient given that I just admitted that I used to be into the idea. But I do think that they are pernicious, wrong, and we should intervene. But what do you think?
So I think there's conspiracy theories and there's conspiracy theories. So there are some which are really, you know, unmoored and kind of crazy and deeply hateful and weird. And I think those often indicate disordered minds. I often, maybe in a more generous mode, think that people who claim to believe them are doing something sort of socially performative. It's the very liberal college student who says, you know, man, the CIA, they're everywhere. You know, they're watching us all the time. And George Bush is going to, his plan is he's not going to relinquish the presidency. When he loses, he's going to take it over.
Open your eyes, man.
Open your eyes, man. Yeah. put down the New York Times and read, you know. And I think some of that is just, you know, to occupy an extreme political position. Sometimes belief in conspiracy theories is just a more emotive thing. I think a lot of people who claim, for instance, that that they believe Barack Obama was not born in the United States were just saying, I don't like Barack Obama. Another poll asked people, do you think Donald Trump was born in the United States? And some substantial percentage said no. And I don't think there's any doubt that Trump was born in the United States. They were just saying, boo, Trump. So those are the sort of extreme theories. Then there's a broader sense of theories, which is just theories that there are conspiracies. So, and there I would say that I think some of these are just hard cases and people struggle and sometimes they get it wrong. I quote in the book, The Washington Post, they have this wonderful quiz called Know Your Conspiracy. And they list, they give a list of several conspiracies and you have to tick off whether it's true or false. So for instance, some of them, they say, are false. Hillary Clinton conspired to provide Russia with nuclear material. Say, that's wrong. During Ronald Reagan's presidency, government officials illegally sold weapons to Iran and used the money to fund Nicaraguan revolutionaries. That's right. And some of the ones that are right, say involving the CIA doping people with LSD, sound crazy, but they're true. But
they're true.
And some of the ones that are wrong, you say, I didn't know that was wrong. And so sometimes I worry that we use conspiracy theorists as an epithet to people who believe different conspiracies than we do.
I think that's right. And it makes me want to walk back the strength with which I issued my opinion, because it would be unfair to say By conspiracy, I mean all of those beliefs that are wrong that involve multiple people in power colluding and hiding the evidence. And by non-conspiracy, I mean all of the beliefs that are right.
That's right.
That wouldn't be fair. How about this as a claim? I believe that it is the case that if you believe, for instance, that there are lizard people, you are more likely statistically to believe a completely unrelated conspiracy theory. There were multiple shooters for JFK.
Yes.
Or something else. That, to me, is getting at something which I think to be right. That is, that I believe that there are some people who have such a low threshold for what would count as evidence to believe in a conspiracy that they accumulate them as part of their set of beliefs more quickly. And so I think that that is the sort of thing that I believe should be avoided, a sign of an undisciplined mind. But if there is evidence that the FBI was surveilling Martin Luther King, then of course believe it. It just shouldn't say anything about whether or not the moon landing happened.
I like that way of looking at things, but it sort of cuts both ways. So you could think of this and a lot of other psychological traits as on a continuum. There's a dial you could turn, and people are in different settings of the dial. So it's true for something like anxiety. Some people are hyper-anxious, and that's awful for them. They suffer from all sorts of problems. They avoid opportunities that they would enjoy. Some people aren't anxious enough. The evolutionary psychiatrist, Rudolf Nessie, says we sort of have names for people with anxiety disorders, and we find them in hospitals. And people with very little anxieties, we find in morgues.
And mountaineering documentaries.
And then that's right. You're either dead or you have a documentary based on you or both. And I think it's the same thing for conspiratorial belief. So you're pointing one side of the dial. You could have it turn too high, but you could also have it turn too low. You would have it turn too low. You could be
a sucker. You're a sucker.
You're a sucker. That's right. That's right. I say, oh, David, those people you're talking to, they're trying to scam money off of you. You say, no, conspiracies don't exist. They're fair dealers. They told me what they're up to. And plainly, that would be wrong, too. So there's a dial to be turned. Your point, your intuition is people, they're too sensitive.
Yeah.
And you could imagine a sort of evolutionary argument that goes as follows. There are conspiracies in the world. There are people get together and plan against you. I've been involved in a few. I've been in academics for a long time, you know. A bunch of people get together in a room and say, look, we want this plan to go forth. So let's do this, that, and other, and not tell this person. So we're sensitive to it. Maybe it's better on the whole to be overly sensitive and then get some wrong. See a conspiracy when none exists, than to be insensitive and then caught up when there's one that you never noticed.
It's hard to lump things together into conspiracy theories if all we're doing is saying they involve deception and they involve a smaller number of people, deceiving a larger number of people. Some of them, for them to be true, would require such implausible things to have occurred that it seems like anybody who has a system to should discard that immediately. And maybe all I'm saying is that there are certain conspiracy theories for which my red flags go off. Let me give you an example. There's a TikToker I just came across who claims at least to believe that Rome isn't real. Have you heard of this woman?
No.
So she believes
Rome.
The city, the ancient civilization. She believes that the evidence for their accomplishments, the archaeological evidence and the evidence in the written record, has all been faked in order to elevate the status of European history. That is one of those cases where you have to discard so much of the information.
Yeah, that's right.
That you should not probably discard, including if you don't believe the archaeological record about this, then it means you can't believe it about a whole bunch of other things. That's one of those red flag ones to me.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think faking the moon landing being another example.
Right.
Which is, of course, it's possible.
Flat Earth.
Flat Earth being another one, yeah.
And those are the kinds of examples that people like me trot out when asked why conspiracy people are kooks. I don't bring out Jeffrey Epstein might not have killed himself.
That's right.
And maybe that's unfair of me.
So the question when assessing rationality then is how many people adhere to the crazy conspiratorial theory? Say you and me and most other people would just say that's just it's possible, but it's just too low probability. And I guess I'm not sure. My bet is when it comes to believe in some interesting sense, far fewer than the people who say yes when they're asked in anonymous polls. I think sometimes they do it just because, for one reason, for social reasons, you know, it gives sort of social cachet to be the person who believed that, you know, George Bush, you know, wasn't responsible for 9/11 attacks. I think sometimes it's almost recreational.
Yeah.
In an interesting discussion, Steven Pinker in his book On Rationality makes the analogy to certain forms of celebrity gossip, which are often extremely implausible and really unbelievable. But they're kind of fun. And the cost of knowing them makes you an entertaining person at parties. The cost of getting them wrong is nothing.
That's a good point. The costs involved. You might propose the hypothesis that the closer a decision is to mattering for your ultimate survival, maybe the less likely you are to ignore evidence.
Yeah.
If I get a notice that my car has been recalled for faulty brakes, I don't think, there go GM and Ford, you know, and Toyota pulling the strings to ruin my day. But whatever, moon landing, who knows? And I think what you were saying before, it does send a signal, maybe. I am not a sucker who believes that I'm under control of my destiny in the way that you seem to believe.
Yeah, and I think there's often a moral emotive pull about this, which is that when the people in charge are people who we don't like, who we believe hate us, maybe correctly, we're much more likely to have conspiratorial thinking about them.
This gets back to the broad question of what rationality is. It's tempting to think, if I take a course on logic, then I'll really know not to make these sorts of errors. But those are the easy cases. Logical principles and math, if you follow the rules, you'll get the right answer. But Kahneman and Tversky set out specifically to study what they call judgment under uncertainty. And that is when the information is incomplete, imperfect, you have to make probabilistic judgments. There is so much debate about what the right answer ought to be with some of these questions that it makes the challenge for a human in modern society so much more difficult. So rationality really has come to mean, it's a very high bar. It's hard to know what it would even mean to be a perfectly rational creature.
It is. And there's also an important distinction here, because you could define rationality, and here I'm drawing from Pinker's definition, which I think is pretty good, using knowledge and logic and probability to achieve your goals. Sometimes the cases are really simple. If it's raining outside and you don't want to get wet, you should bring an umbrella. But it depends on your goals. So if you like dancing in the rain and getting soaked, bring an umbrella is stupid. Just, you have to lug it around. Why do you want to do that? If you want to do proper sports betting to maximize your chance, your amount of money you make, you should be rational about your home team's odds. If you're with a bunch of people in a sports bar and you don't want to get punched in the head, you probably should cheer for your sports team regardless. That's rational. If your goal is to be popular in the crowd. So, but what this means is, alongside rationality and the question of how rational are you, and I think the answer should be always as rational as you can be, there's the question is, what goals should you have? And to some extent, that falls more into discussion of the emotions and to evolution and to morality, actually. I say in the book, if all you care about making money is making money, maybe kidnapping a child is a perfectly rational thing to do. But you should care about other things too.
Some people describe a certain kind of psychopath as ultimately rational.
Yeah.
Psychopaths who may not be encumbered by moral emotions could do very well in following steps A, B, and C, and D in order to achieve goal E, which is torturing somebody.
So, you know, Hans Gruber, when he took over the building to do this heist and involved the death of many people, was immoral and monstrous, but his plan was a pretty good one.
Right.
there's a terrible reference.
So maybe we go full circle here to Hume, who said it's not contrary to reason to prefer the destruction of the world to the scratching of my little finger.
I really believe that. I think in some way it nicely bifurcates psychology. We're talking here about how rational people are. And, you know, the answer is not perfectly, imperfect. But sometimes we do better than others. And you know, we system one, system two. But then there's a second question, which is, what should we want? And there, I think it just deals with other issues. Somebody who cheers for their team, even if their team has no real chance of doing well, it seems ridiculous for me to say, oh, you're being irrational. Well, you know, am being irrational. If my goal is to get a proper assessment, I'm not being irrational if I love my team and feel like I want to stick with them.
So the answer you're saying is it's complicated.
Yes. Why don't we end with that?